call the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order. While our senators are up here, we'll have a subcommittee of the full committee on House Bill 5045. Today we're going to continue with the state police budget, and today we have the state medical examiner's office. Dr. Gunderson.
Good morning, Chairman Patridge and committee members. My name is Dr. Karen Gunson, and I'm the state medical examiner and division director for the state medical examiner's office. I've been with the state medical examiner's office for 17 years, and the last 3.5 as the state medical examiner. The state medical examiner's office is charged with investigating death here in the state of Oregon by ORS 146. ORS 146 gives us jurisdiction over certain cases. We're charged with investigating all violent or unusual deaths that would include homicides, suicides, and accidents. The law also charges us with investigating all drug overdoses, whether they're from street drugs or prescription medications. Anybody who dies in state custody falls under the medical examiner's law, so that'd be anybody in the back of a police car, state penitentiary, and hospital facilities under state control. Anybody who dies on the job falls under the medical examiner's law. Anybody who dies and not under the care of a physician or outside of a hospital falls under the medical examiner's law. We're also, because of our position, charged with teaching various different groups, including the medical school, people at the medical school, police officers, district attorneys, defense attorneys, and other physicians. We spend a lot of time on the phone with police agencies, district attorneys, and other groups, giving them technical advice about forensic pathology. We testify in court on numerous occasions, of course, after having done homicide autopsies. And we spend a lot of time on the phone with loved ones, with next of kin, explaining to them why their family members have died. We use our budget to run the death investigation program. And that would include four forensic pathologists at the medical examiner's office in Portland. We are supported by two medical transcriptionists and one forensic administrator. Those seven people run the entire death investigation program in the state of Oregon, overseeing county medical examiners in every county who are physicians. We also provide toxicology services for the entire state of Oregon, including the blood alcohol program, which is mandated by law for anybody who dies in a traffic accident over the age of 12. We provide a contract for Lane County for forensic pathology services as well out of our budget. In the past, we have provided autopsy reimbursement for counties who have done.
You provide Lane County contracts with you to provide services?
Lane County, we provide a contract to two forensic pathologists in Lane County to provide Lane County services, Lane County forensic pathology services, through our budget.
Why does it come through your budget?
Because it has been, it's over 200,000 people in that Lane County, and for the last 35 years, according to ORS 146, if there is a county over 200,000 people, we can provide forensic pathology services through the medical examiner's office, through the state office. And that's how we have worked it for the last 35 years.
Multnomah County doesn't do that.
Multnomah County, we are the medical examiner for Multnomah County, for Clackamas County, for Washington County, and for Wheeler County, because Wheeler County doesn't have any physicians.
I've never really understood the mechanizations of that. I know Multnomah County funds a significant portion of the medical examiner's office.
Chairman Patridge,
what's the differentiation between Multnomah County, Washington County, and Lane County? Are they all funded in the same way, or?
Chair Patridge and Representative Hansen, there is a little bit of difference. For 40 years, the state medical examiner's office has been housed at Multnomah County Medical Examiner's Office.
And a delightful building it was housed in, too.
Pearson Funeral Home, yes. We're still there. And they provide the death investigators, or our deputy medical examiners, and our pathology assistants, as well as one secretary. We provide four forensic pathologists. Now, Washington County provides death investigators, as does Clackamas County, and they send their cases to the Multnomah County facility. They also pay rent to Multnomah County for that privilege. For Lane County, we provide a contract to cover essentially the cost of one forensic pathology to handle all the cases in Lane County. The current medical examiner there has chosen to split it, so there are two forensic pathologists there, but it's the same amount of money.
Well, Lane County receives state money to provide theirs?
Yes, sir. The contractor does. We have a contract with a forensic pathologist in Lane County to provide the services in Lane County.
But are those paid for by past Bill, maybe you can you jump in here? I don't understand the funding stream.
Mr. Chair, Bill, yes. The state does fund a portion of the budget here for those dollars that are then paid to the contractor by the medical examiner's office. So it's not so much a pass-through, it's a payment for services under an agreed contract.
So if we have an Lane County has an intergovernmental agreement with the state, they pay the state money and the state then provides a medical exam?
No, sir.
Mr. Chair, the state is responsible for these services for all counties. Certain large counties or statutory provisions that rather than have the bodies come to Portland and do the bodies in Portland or find a individual physician that we can enter a contract for services in that area. It's really
Can you maybe diagram? I'm sorry I'm a little slow, but a chart would help me.
Can I get Bill to give us the walk on this too? Do you have your walk on it, Bill?
Yes. Can we go ahead and do that now?
If I can get that to,
that would be helpful to
It's a geographic coverage issue, I think, more than anything else. It's how the state provides services to that part of that very heavily populated part of the state. Without actually having
right. What I'm interested in doing is if we got
while we're passing these out, if we've got these counties here, right? I'm not an artist. We got these counties that are these are what 200K and above,
correct?
And then we have your office here, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And then we provision out.
We oversee and provide forensic pathology services for all the northwest corner of the state, including Clatsop, Columbia, Lincoln, Tillamook County. We provide all the services for Hood River, Umatilla, Wheeler, Gilliam, Malheur, all the counties east. Of course, they have to transport bodies to our office. So occasionally what will happen is if we have a clearly natural death in one of those outlying counties, we have hospital pathologists who are willing to do some of those cases. Those hospital pathologists are then paid by the county for their services. In the past, we have reimbursed those counties approximately 40% of their costs for doing those autopsies for us. Or if they have to transport them to our office, we provide them with about 40% of their transportation costs. We have had to cut that out over the last year. We don't reimburse anymore for autopsy services or transportation services provided by any of these outlying counties. If we have a county that has over 200,000 people, the state medical examiner may designate a deputy state medical examiner and pay for that deputy state medical examiner to cover the forensic pathology services in that county. Lane County is so populous that we put a forensic pathologist there to cover those services without having them have to transport.
But say Lane County is B right there, okay?
Okay.
Say Lane County is B. So do they pay money to you?
No, we pay money to them. We have a contract with them to provide forensic pathology services in that county. They're essentially part of the state medical examiner's office. They're just not housed.
So all you're doing is, so I'm putting the medical examiners in the squares on the right.
Correct.
So if the squares on the right are the state, are actually the person who is doing it in the county on B. So B is the medical examiner.
Correct.
In Lane County. The funding stream comes from, you pay state general fund to Lane County that then contracts
to a venture contractor.
To a contractor. I pay the money to the county.
So here, let me do this a little differently then. Am I understanding
that? No, I keep going because I'm going to ask the same about the Deschutes and Malheur and Lane County.
This is general fund. I'm assuming this is general fund. And these are the counties. And these are the people doing the work. Okay? What I'm saying is, if you're, and these are the counties, so let's just call this, let's call B Lane. So in Lane County, can you pick this up on the microphone? In Lane County, we have, this is your medical professional, this is your people, right? They're receiving state general fund dollars?
The contract forensic pathologist is receiving state general fund dollars.
Now, does the state medical examiner, your office, get any money from Lane County?
No.
Okay. So what if you're under 200? What if I'm like, well, my county's Jackson.
Jackson County contracts with Dr. Jim Olson.
Right. I know Dr. Olson.
Right. To provide forensic pathology services, and we have reimbursed them by 40% for that contract.
Okay. So what happens is you pay Jackson County 40%, mm-hmm. but they pay Dr. Olson 100%. I'm in a more populous county, I pay less.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Not your county.
If you're Multnomah County.
Okay.
If you're Multnomah County, we have four forensic pathologists in Portland.
But they're state staff.
But Multnomah County provides six medical examiners, six deputy medical examiners, or investigators, to investigate the scene of death and report back to us. Multnomah County also provides two forensic pathology assistants to help us in the back room doing autopsies, as well as the secretary and the building.
So they're giving you in-kind services, in a sense, for Multnomah County and other counties
in Northwestern.
And you said Washington County provides some in-kind services, too.
Washington County provides death investigators, as does Clackamas County, and they pay Multnomah County, who owns a facility, rent, essentially, for the bodies that they send in there.
So when they pay rent, what do you mean by rent?
They pay them, they pay them money every year. I believe it's $24,000 for Clackamas County, $30,000 for Clackamas County, and $24,000 from Washington County goes to Multnomah County to fund the running of that central facility so that we can do autopsies there.
Okay.
Malheur County. Does Malheur County on an autopsy get 40% back from the state?
We have until just recently when we had to cut that out of our budget.
Cut out Malheur County, but you didn't cut out Jackson or Lane?
No. Representative. Jackson was cut out as well. Lane County still retains their contract.
That's a pretty scruffy deal, Mr. Chair. I'm going to tell you that straight out.
All right.
And there's no one from Lane County on this committee.
Got some issues here I think the people look at.
Is there any other? I just want to know, besides the in-kind services, the Lane County sweetheart deal, and the way the other counties are treated, are those the only really, there's three ways that we fund this, three ways that services are put out through Europe. Is there any additional?
No, Chairman.
We're not trading three pigs and a goat for
managed
services.
Sounds like my dad's first company deal.
All right.
Chairman Patridge, we only have 7 forensic pathologists in the entire state. And if we did not fund Lane County in this way, we would have to hire another forensic pathologist to take over. Or we'd have to bring those bodies up to our office.
Well, Lane County could pay 60% of the freight like every other county in the state.
That's not a bad idea. Put that in the form of a motion. I'll second it.
Representative Chair Patridge, may I speak for a moment?
Yeah. I'm open.
All right, good.
I wouldn't suggest you go down that path, but if you want to, you're open to it.
We've always hoped that we could have a regional system in the forensic pathology to provide forensic pathology services to the state. That is, have state-paid forensic pathologists who would cover Southern Oregon, of course, the Portland metropolitan area, place somebody possibly in Pendleton and one in Bend in order to have a more uniform coverage of the state.
So I'm interested then in a couple things when we look at this. I'm interested in trying to do some kind of apples-to-apples comparison. I'm interested in if you will provide, I don't know, the counties that provide the in-kind services, whether it's Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah, the value of those in-kind services versus how much is expended for those particular counties so that we can... I mean, I know that Multnomah County is giving you a building and some of those other things. We're moving you out of the building now. We're moving you into a state building. State's paid all the upgrade costs. You know, I don't know if you're moving the staff that they're giving you there too. But, you know, are they state employees or are they Multnomah County employees?
Chairman Patridge, they would be the Multnomah County death investigators, the one secretary, and the pathology assistants would move over and then pay rent to the state.
Okay. I'd like to see a breakout of the value, like I said, the value of those services and what then the state pays out.
Why? I'd like to be on the Multnomah. You have 2 county commissioners here, previous county commissioners. I'd like to be on the Multnomah County Commission. I mean the Lane County Commission.
I'd like to be on the Multnomah County Commission as far as that goes, but that but we have term limits, and that's another story. Anyway, the other thing that would help in terms of the differentiation of why these costs have evolved the way they have, and the state medical examiner people that are clearly a state responsibility, that the state has always provided this service. The medical investigators, what I'm assuming is that in some of the other counties, medical investigations are done by other law enforcement people. In trying to understand this, which is a state function and which is a county function?
Chairman Patrick, Representative Hansen, the forensic pathology services are the state function. The local death investigation programs are run by local people. That is, there is in every county a physician county medical examiner who oversees that program. They are assisted by, as you say, multiple law enforcement people who are called deputy medical examiners, who are our eyes and ears on the street.
Bill, can we have you do your walk, and then we'll come back?
Okay, I think you've got those answers. The budget is the governor's budget is $3.3 million general fund and $1 million other funds. The the other funds increase is primarily due to the COPs to equip the new facility. The general fund increase is increased cost in the contract, which has traditionally been underfunded, and the rent on the cost of the new facility. Primarily, you see this budget is 76% general fund. Once we move past the COP issue, it will be almost entirely general fund. The issues in the special sessions are the reduction in the autopsy payments you heard about, and then the compensation funding for 0103. the governor's budget issues really are the rent and equipment costs of the new facility and increased funding for toxicology and forensics pathology contracts. The forensics pathology contract is the Lane County issue. There's also there's also a longstanding contract with Oregon Health and Sciences University for toxicology services, which had also been traditionally underfunded and had to be made up by the department. Budget is, as you see, about 50% personal services, about 47% services supplies, and 3% special payments for the money that had gone out to the counties. That's the general fund budget, just to show you the increased capital outlay. And the total funds budget is, again, because of the cost for new equipment for the facility. The steps to get to the budget, we started at $2.3 million general fund, $2.3 million total funds as well. Nothing in the emergency boards, early emergency boards, nothing in second special session. Base budget adjustments are the standard personal services roll-ups and merit increases that you'll strip out. Package 10 is, again, the same for vacancy savings and fix. There's nothing unusual about the inflation state government service charge package. Package 81 was a hit against the autopsy payment to the county medical examiners. That was a $37,000 general fund reduction. Package 83, the October emergency board, that was the department's rebalance again, that increased general fund by $462,000 to deal with it, what had been long-term underfunding of both of those two contracts. So it actually moved money from other parts of the department into this division in order to really secure the appropriate level of funding for to pay for those services. Going on to the unique policy packages, 134, the reduction of $85,000 general fund. When we projected the contracts out to the 0305 budget, we projected that we'd moved a little bit too much in the October reward, so we pulled it back to get down to what the need level was. Packages 135 and 136 are both related to the new facility. 135 pays the cost of the rent at the new facility, including the debt service costs that are the DAS pays as the owner. And 136 is the other fund's COP limitation for equipment costs to begin to start up. And there are no either revenue issues and there are no technical adjustments.
Mr. Chairman,
just a question relative to the, and I know that you had a lengthy discussion on the lab. I watched it the other day for the balance of the forensic equipment. Is there any discussion about leasing some of this forensic equipment as opposed to outright purchases?
Representative Butler, there's no avenue for that. The equipment that we have now is out of date and owned by Multnomah County. And as far as leasing, what we need are autopsy tables and coolers, and that's basically what we're buying. And well, there's no way to lease those items. We'll have to buy them outright.
That's the $374,000. No,
that's $900,000.
That's the $909,000. That is the debt service.
That's the, just the COPs for it. The debt service will be in the next presentation. It's in human, it's budget and human services, and we'll talk about that in the next division.
Let me jump back then to page 6 of the presentation, actually 6 and 5. Services and supplies, 47% of general fund, 43% of the entire budget, services and supplies. Does that include this payment that's being made to Lane County?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And so Lane County, as I see it, is the only county in the state that is really receiving the entire package of the original medical examiner services. I mean,
without any additional contribution.
Without any additional contribution. They were receiving it without any local payment.
So, Representative Butler, no local payment to us. They do have their, of course, death investigation program, which they pay for locally.
So does everybody else.
Correct.
Right. Okay. All right.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, I question the comment that you can't lease those tables and so forth. I mean, you can lease everything in one of these offices. It's just a matter of finding, you know, those folks that would do it. And I'd have to say that I know that there are places that will lease everything, including that cooler space, to go into them. So it may be a way that we can look at a lease package.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and let Dr. Gunson proceed with the rest of the presentation.
Right.
Now that we got sidetracked.
So rudely interrupted.
Chairman Patridge, Actually, we've probably pretty much covered it. We are going to continue using our budget allotment for providing statewide forensic pathology services to the people of Oregon, as we always have, including our toxicology. And we plan on using our new facility so we'll have a safer working environment for our people and for citizens who visit, plus police agencies who have to come into our services.
Okay. Anything else?
Chair, just a clarification. How much is left in the budget for reimbursement to counties in the governor's budget? Is there any left, or I can't remember, and I have it written down, but I don't have it written.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Danny Bisgard, budget director. About $85,000 is left, and that probably will pay about 20% each year for autopsy payments, about half of what we have been paying in the past.
Okay, so 25%?
I'd say 20% to 40%.
I'd like to see a table maybe that just has the 36 counties listed that has the various funding that you pay for, whether it be the autopsy itself, whether it be the transportation to your facility. I'd like to know how much the state's picking up, and then how much the state's picking up, how much each of the counties are picking up for the various areas of service. Because I don't understand the full field of, you know, you pay for service. You know, you play for rubber gloves in some counties and don't know. I mean, I don't know what the. Because it sounds like you have kind of a hybrid and trying to get from apples to apples. So it's going to be interesting.
Mr. Chair, I just need to say something. That at a minimum, where all other counties have been cut off 100% of even receiving the 40%, that the monies, the resources, this rather substantial resource that goes to pay one county probably ought to be spread around the other approximately 30 counties in the state.
Chair Patridge, one of the reasons that we have a forensic pathologist stationed in Lane County is because of the high workload there. Many of the other counties only have one or two deaths that need to be covered a year by our office or need to have any attention paid to them by the medical examiner system.
No, I understand that particular piece, but it doesn't seem like a rational policy argument to me, but maybe I'd be happy to talk about that. Dr. The other piece that we're always looking at too is where, you know, is there anything statutorily that currently the state medical examiner's office examines that really has not contributed to in any substantial way to the criminal investigations or other issues? I mean, it's great to look at it, you know, it's great to look at everything, but are there classes of deceased persons that we look at that maybe other states don't look at, or we look at that we don't garner anything?
Chair Patridge, we have a fairly standard system. This is a fairly uniform group of people that we look at, that every other state does look at. When we look at people who die or not in the care of a physician, we're actually looking for such things as unidentified homicides. We're looking for drug overdoses that may have occurred that might affect other people out there. We're looking for, in many ways, a public health issue in those particular instances. We're also screening for such things as unusual infectious diseases, such as smallpox and anthrax. That's part of our job as well. So that group is a particularly important group, I think, to keep an eye on. And no other group in the state, no other agency looks at those particular people.
But what about the automobile accidents and those kinds of things?
Every state will look at, every state and county in this United States looks at automobile accidents. One of the reasons we look at those is for the fact that we want to know how we can make those automobiles safer. And we report that back to National Transportation Safety as well as to the Health Division.
I'd like to, I guess, too, I'd also be interested in getting a list of those items, the types of deaths that you have versus what you discovered, led to a criminal investigation, led to a public health risk, led to whatever the classifications, the rationale behind. What's the rational public policy behind providing the investigation? I mean, some of them are clear on their face. Others, I think, may be less tangential. And I'd be interested to know if anything's being discussed. It's great to do them, and maybe in one case we can save millions of dollars. And that probably is the case, too. But I need to have a better understanding as we make really, really tough public policy decisions in the state right now. If we haven't for 10 years, done a particular type of investigation, not discovered anything of significant value for the state to look at from a public policy perspective, it's something we still should be doing. So that's where I want to put your hands on.
Mr. Chair, one of the aspects of your office that really interests me and I think is incredibly valuable is from the public health aspect. In terms of, this is our first warning that we get in terms of the exotic diseases, public health outbreaks that could really dwarf criminal problems if something got started and we weren't able to react quickly. So I think that's incredibly important. But one of the things that might come out from the exercise that the chair has suggested is whether looks like the bulk of the cost of your agency is actually pretty well fixed in terms of, but giving you discretion, a little more discretion in terms of what autopsies you're going to perform, so that in some cases that you might be able to balance workload or something a little better. On the other hand, trying to come up with a specific list. When you've got a great deal of fixed cost, there may be times when it's really not a huge savings in terms of not doing a particular class of them.
Right.
But I'd be interested in seeing that list to see whether or not statutorily maybe we could give you more discretion in terms of which are the ones that you feel are the most important. And so if, anyway, then.
Anything further? Appreciate you coming. Sorry to.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you doing the walkthrough on the board with us. That was very, very helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one question?
Of course, Representative Butler.
I really have to ask this, Dr. Benson, but the state, you're the director of the department of the state medical examiner's office. Does the statute provide that director needs to be an MD?
Yes, the statute provides that director must be a forensic pathologist.
Okay. Is, in your opinion, because of the responsibilities, executive responsibilities, and all the ancillary responsibilities of managing a team and so forth, does it need to be a pathologist? Does it need to be a forensic pathologist?
Chair Patrick, Representative Butler, I believe that we need to have a pathologist oversee this program from a medical point of view. And I do believe that with our forensic administrator that we have, who does take some of that burden of, say, preparing
administration
off of me, I still perform over 200 cases a year.
Okay, well, I needed to know that because this would be much like in a hospital arrangement, having the chief brain surgeon of a hospital have to be the hospital administrator because, they've just worked their way to the top in the profession, and that really doesn't make a lot of sense, and that's why I wanted to ask you that question. Thank you,
Patrick. I feel very strongly about that, and thank you very much for that question.
Appreciate it. All right. Thanks. Human Resources Division is next.
Mr. Is it Weiss?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Weiss. I'm the Human Resource Services Director. The Human Resource Services Division consists of many components. The Office of the Superintendent, Business Services, and Special Operations, to name a few. The primary purpose of this division is to provide leadership, establish policy, and provide support to the department as a whole. The division operates within the authority of various statutory chapter law relating to such things as budget administration, purchasing, contracting, fiscal management, and other related statutory responsibilities we have. This budget transfers the training division to this division. It also transfers the Communication Command Center to the Central Operations Command within Human Resources from the Office of Information Management Technology. What I'd like to do is spend a couple of minutes just talking about the various components of Human Resources, because we're not just your standard administrative services kind of a structure. And then I'd ask Bill McGee to get into the financial or the budget figures. The Office of the Superintendent consists of the Superintendent, the Deputy Superintendent, and one support position. We have an Office of Professional Standards. This section consists of the labor relations, internal investigations, and management review activities for the department. We have six programs in the business services operations. They are personnel, payroll, fiscal services, procurement and supplies, contracts and leases, and the fleet management central install. And as I mentioned earlier, we now have the training section, which consists of two major program areas. They're responsible for our sworn applicant processing, and they're also responsible for overall workforce development for the agency as a whole. The Central Operations Field Command is responsible for managing three major programs. It's the Operations Field Support, the Field Communication Command Centers, and the Regional and Patrol Office Commands. Human Resource Services Division is also responsible for managing the debt service expenditures and payments as a whole for the department. And Human Resources is also responsible for one benchmark. This benchmark, number 66, involves community-based cooperative policing. I think you heard the superintendent discuss the department's activities involving this benchmark in his remarks earlier on, so I won't repeat those now, unless you have questions about it. Factors affecting our services. We find that the services provided by the Human Resource Services Division are influenced by the fluctuation in program activity in other divisions of the department. An example would be in our personnel payroll activities, as other divisions hire staff, that impacts the level of activity that we're involved with. And then recently we got to experience too, when you lay off people in other divisions and our own division, that too adds some workload to staff. Our fiscal section services fluctuate as funds are available that are available or used to purchase goods and services relating to their division activities. Our administrative cost for the Human Resource Services Division is about 5.7% of the total division budget. And I think at this time, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to turn it over to Bill McGee for his budget information.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Bill McGee for the record. The budget for, and you have your opinion, thank you, the budget for this division is $34.4 million general fund, about $1.4 million other funds, and $136,000 federal funds. Primarily, it's a general fund budget. About 96% comes from the general fund. Other funds, the primary source of that is the criminal fines and assessment account allocation for training of state police officers, and very small amount of federal grant funds. Major changes during the special sessions, there were 60 positions of administration, business services, and training that were eliminated. The reductions, again, in services, supplies, and capital outlay. Of course, the compensation was funded at 75% of the estimated need. Excuse me. And there was a fund shift to revenue that was anticipated from the sale of the remaining King Air aircraft. Governor's budget continued the special session reductions into the 03-05 budget. approved the reorganization of divisions and programs. Again, the training division and dispatch centers were transferred into this division from others. And there's also increased debt service and financing costs for the COPs for the new forensics lab and medical officer exam room, Clackamas, that we just talked about. In terms of the categories of the budget, page 5 of the total funds, 59% personal services, 36% services supplies, a small amount of capital outlay, and a small amount of debt service. The starting point for this budget was about $20.4 million general fund and $21.4 million total funds. No early emergency board actions. The second special session reduced the budget by about $2.3 million general fund and 8 positions, 3 sworn, 5 non-sworn, reductions in service supplies, capital outlay, the direction to sell the remaining King Air, and some various administrative reductions. The budget adjustments, again, the roll-up on personnel services costs and merit increases, and also an increase in debt service costs that fully phase in the debt service on the equipment that was purchased for the Emergency Coordination or C4 Center here in Salem. Essential packages, vacancy savings, non-picks, pretty standard there. Phase-in, phase-out one-timers, restoration of one-time reductions and phase-outs from the second special session, and the elimination of the expenditure elimination for the COP financing costs and for the sale of the King Air, and the phase-out of the 7K issue as well. Package 30, again, pretty standard inflation takeover and service charges, nothing unusual here from what we've seen before. Package 60 increased this division's budget by $12.6 million general fund, $12.8 total funds, and 81 positions. Here we had the shift from the dispatch centers from information management into human resources, and the supervision of the SWAT team and the mobile response team moving out from human resources to patrol. We talked about that during that division. Package 70 is the reduction in criminal fines assessment account for the training budget. Again, the issue we've discussed numbers of times in subcommittee. Here had an impact of $846,000 other funds and the loss of 5 positions. Given the overall loss of positions in the department, this reduction was not restored, resulting in a lower level of training services. Third special session, another $1.4 million reduction of general fund, 6 more positions eliminated, including the cost of living increase for salary range 38 above. There were 7 sworn managers eliminated. One lieutenant was established by eliminating 3 non-sworn managers of information management. This became part of the dispatch transfer that went over for a different management structure there. Services, supplies, and capital outlay reduced, and some additional administrative reductions. The package 82, the specified reductions from the 5th special session, this was $108,000 general fund reduced services, supplies, and capital outlays. The emergency board rebalance in October, package 83, increased this division's budget by $973,000 general fund. This was primarily shifting vacancy and other savings into what had traditionally been underfunded services supplies accounts, vehicle operations, data processing, and attorney general costs. 5th special session, the unspecified reductions. Here were another 46 management training and business services positions were eliminated, with a roll-up for this biennium of about $6.3 million general fund, and again, the elimination of 46 positions. Specific packages for Human Resources Division, package 125. This completed the transfer of the training division into Human Resources as it was eliminated from a standalone division, and the transfer of one major to the Criminal Investigations Division to be part of the Office of Public Safety and Security. Package 126 has $627,500 general fund, $85,000 other funds. This is a debt service and the COP financing cost for the new Clackamas Forensics Lab medical examiner equipment and finance furnishings that we just talked about. Human Resources also, package 130, some workload issues here, resulting in a reduction of general fund by about $168,000, eliminating one position. This completed the transfer of the Safe Kids program, which previously had been in this department, to the Department of Human Services. And with the transfer, there was, of course, reduction of funding. And their reclassification of 2 positions by shifting services, supplies, and personal services. So, again, the reclassifications were funded with no additional dollars. Training workload, 2 positions and 0.83 FTE were established. And here again, as I've seen a couple of times before, we've shifted some money from temporaries to salaries and benefits to establish a couple of part-time limited duration positions for temporary training assignments, again, with no increase in dollars. The former training division, package 133, eliminated that division to complete the transfer to human services, and that just shifted $858,000 and five positions out. There are no fee or revenue changes here. A couple of technical adjustments. One, we overshifted services supplies to personal services. There were a couple of reclassifications that were requested that were eventually eliminated as part of the 5100 reduction, so we don't need to shift as much as we did. And again, we need to correct the personal services estimates that were used to prepare the initial estimates once we knew the final numbers and we loaded them in the system. The result of that netted out at the reducing general fund by about $2,000.
I'd like to go to the org chart, which is on page 8. I know you have you walking through a little bit that particular piece. Were you going to go again, Mr. Weiss?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Okay, I'll let you go, and then maybe you will answer my question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is add a little bit of perspective to some of these reductions that we experienced, and then I have a couple of other points that I want to make sure we include in our presentation. Human Resource Services Division lost 46 positions out of the 119 in base budget, as you just heard, and that equates to 39%. And I just kind of want to walk through all these program areas I discussed earlier that were components and just kind of give you a perspective of what that impact did to each of these programs. The Office of the Superintendent had a 50% reduction. Our Personnel Office had a 50% reduction. Our Payroll Office had a 50% reduction. Our Fiscal Services lost 45% of its capacity. Our Procurement and Supplies section lost 75%. Our fleet and installation lost 67% of our capacity. These are people, that delivered these services. Our contracts and leases lost 100%. In our training unit, our sworn application section lost 100%. Our training unit lost 56%. Our communication command center lost 24%. And our regional patrol offices lost 37%. We lost our ability to maintain good internal controls and accountability in critical areas in fiscal management, inventory control, contract purchase compliance, and other personnel management activities. As you've heard the superintendent speak and others speak, we too will do our very best with the resources we have. But I also want to make it known that we will not be able to do everything we should be doing. The last couple of points I'd like to make, if I may, we do have a facility strategic plan.
Can you specify for us what things you're not going to be doing in this position?
Some of the concerns that I have, Mr. Chair, involve, for example, our cash management. We used to have pretty good accounting controls on opening the mail, making sure we have good accountability of cash that comes into the agency. We no longer have the number of staff it's going to take to maintain that kind of an internal control. We spend literally millions of dollars in supplies for this agency to keep our officers and other programs operating. We have an inventory control system. The Secretary of State audit in the past has called to our attention the need to make sure we're paying attention to managing that inventory. With the 75% reduction in that program area, we're going to buy the supplies, and we're going to try really hard to be accountable for that. But these are just a couple of examples of concerns I have.
Okay.
As I say, on the facility strategic plan, we have 60 leases that we manage for the agency statewide. And again, that isn't just offices. That's all kinds of leases. We have facilities for storage, a couple of airplane hangars, boat storage, and that sort of thing. We also have, which is not part of the facility strategic plan, but 140 microwave tower leases that we manage. And the department did not have any budget notes from last session, the division. And we did have one audit from the Secretary of State Audits Division. They conducted an audit of our payroll program. They identified five items that needed to be corrected. We've responded and corrected all of those items. And that's all I have, sir.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Weiss, just a couple of questions in going through. 34 of the 36 counties have the cooperative policing agreements. What are the two that do not?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to...
I guess I should say, other than that, who is the other one that has the same?
Right off the top of my head, sir, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't have the answer.
I'd like to come back to the performance standard, or the professional standards, rather. You mentioned just briefly that the management review is responsible for conducting the performance audits. And when was the last time that you'd done the performance audits internally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we actually publish, I think, a biennial plan of all of the scheduled management reviews for the agency. And the last one that was concluded involved some field offices. Again, I can't speak specifically to how many they do. That section isn't directly under my purview, but I do know they have a pretty full schedule of
Internal performance review. That's internal auditing, isn't it?
It's really, well, performance review is a little different than internal auditing in the sense that internal audit is really looking at essentially your financial controls. Performance audits, we're looking at program areas to make sure that we're making the best use of our resources.
The reason I called it internal auditing is because you've indicated that you knew that you had internal controls, the lack of internal controls. Was that as a result of a Secretary of State's audit, or was that an internal audit?
No, sir. What, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, what I'm saying here is as a result of the reductions that we've unfortunately had to take, that many of the positions that we have lost now as of the 1st of February have reduced our ability to maintain good internal controls.
Okay. And so the Secretary of State hasn't yet audited that, but do you do an internal audit?
If we had the capacity, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we certainly would. This would be something that we would probably identify to our review team that may be calendared next time around as they develop that schedule and ask them to help us look at these things.
The personnel section has 4 FTE in it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Those 4 folks, is that down substantially from when you had 500 more staff?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we had a staff of 8 before this process started, okay. And now we have 4.
And finally, I noticed that you get 6 positions in training. Do you ever stumble across the DPSST training folks where you're trying to accomplish training that's very similar, or where they could be of greater assistance to maybe shock absorb for some of your training shortfall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think some of our training is actually joint training with other police agencies. Most of our training is certified by DPSST, so we're doing it in lieu of them having to send staff over. And also, our training division is broader than just for our sworn officers. It's for the agency as a whole. So a lot of the training that DPSST offers are oriented primarily toward the sworn officer.
I guess the concern that I have, Mr. Weiss, and that's why this line of questioning relative to the DPSST and your internal training, is that the propensity is to try and maintain a larger staff for training when we actually have an agency which is set up to try and address all those training issues. And then we still have 6 positions in the state police section that addresses training. Is this all of the trainers that you have in the entire in the entire state police budget, just these 6 positions?
Mr. Chair, I have a Lieutenant Fred Dalpit here that I'm going to ask to help help me out with some of these questions, if I may.
Thank you for coming, Lieutenant Dalpit.
Good afternoon. My name is Fred Dalpit. I'm a lieutenant assigned to the Oregon State Police Training Section. And if I heard your question, Senator Butler, Chair Partridge, how many individuals are assigned to training? Is that correct, sir?
Right. And tell me if you would please, Lieutenant, what their duties are in relationship to the same folks at DPSST, and if there was a way that we could help consolidate and utilize some of the DPSST to take some of your training responsibilities and assist with those.
Chair Partridge and Representative Butler, we have two officers that are assigned as regional training officers. One is assigned to our east region, and one is assigned to basically Western Oregon, including Northwest, Southwest regions. Those officers coordinate our mandatory training programs, which is the maintenance of skills that our officers begin with at our basic training academy. Those skills are taught on a continual basis. We do have a schedule for training for each of those skills built into policies that are internal to the agency. So those are two of the positions. We have two staff officers that oversee various programs, including firearms, defensive tactics, verbal judo. Those are the programs those two main individuals cover.
Those are not duplicative services from DPSST?
Sir, Representative Butler and Chair Patridge, I'm not fully versed on what skills each of the employees at DPSST cover. Again, these are officers that primarily deliver training at a maintenance level outside of the academy.
Let me ask you to do this, Lieutenant Dow. What I'd like you to do is communicate with DPSST and outline your training programs.
Mr. Chair, and Danny is going to give us some information about how much total training all of these folks are receiving.
Too. Right. But I think what Representative Butler's getting at is I'd be interested to see a chart that lists the state police training that goes on, the programs that go on, as well as to have a conversation with DPSST that lists if DPSST, in fact, does provide the same or similar skill training. Is that fair?
That'll accomplish it, Mr. Chair.
But we need to know how often. I mean, you have some internal policies as to how often that's trained, and I want to know from DPSST how often they're offering it. Is that?
Yes.
I have a couple other training questions, but I'm ready to let you finish.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I probably ought to get is Danny's email, because I've got that question on the pilot training too.
Do you want to go upstairs and
shoot him a copy of it?
Okay. I had a couple questions on your training. One, I'm also interested to know if you're going to compare apples to apples on your training. One, what of that training is more classroom oriented, whether it's classroom oriented or actually training that is put out in the field, you know, EBOC and some of those kinds of things are not really classroom appropriate. Firearms training and those things are not necessarily appropriate types of training. I'm interested in where I'm going is there other ways that state police can provision that kind of training through telecommunications things, because you have people outlying throughout the entire state of Oregon. Is there a way to do some of that classroom training either through video conferencing or some of those other things that you have the ability to utilize, or maybe you are utilizing them now? I don't know if that is the case or is not. So that training piece was of interest to me. You also explained to the committee, too, how many weeks of basic training you have as opposed to what's offered at the DPSST.
Chair Patridge, our last basic recruit school had, I believe it was 771 hours of training. We accomplished that in approximately 17 weeks, which does include classes during the evening and on a few weekends scattered throughout the run of that basic recruit school. And I believe that DPSST's basic academy is still at 400 hours.
Right. The 10-week training versus 17-week training in basic. I also have a question for you, too, in regard to training. Does state police budget allow you, do your contract, your union contracts allow you to not pay overtime in the basic training portion of your training? I know that it is a problem for DGSST that when they're initially certifying officers, and I want to know if it's a question for you when you're initially putting people through the program, they could do it in a shorter time period if they didn't have to pay overtime for your officers, because it is a residential kind of boot campish kind of program. And my understanding is the way some of the state or the way some of the local contracts are written, that makes it difficult to do that. I would like to know what state police would be able to do if that, one, is an impediment, and two, if there's anything you could do within your training budget to save money if you were able to change that particular clause on your in doing basic academy, or in basic training of officers.
Chair Patridge, I know there are provisions within the Oregon State Police Officers Association contract that addresses hours spent at basic recruit school training, and there's clause provision in that contract language for how any excess hours are covered.
And do you know what, I mean, you've been doing this a while, I don't
well,
know.
Mr. Chair, the contract does allow us to, at the school, to invoke the Fair Labor Standards 171-hour monthly issue. As a result, when we look at that, we do work our folks more than 40 hours a week. We do not incur a penalty of overtime until we hit 171 hours over that. Traditionally, we don't normally get to that point. And if one were to take a look at our school, and because of that process, that allows the school to be at 17 weeks instead of, if we went 40 hours and did have a problem with overtime, we'd be there for 22 weeks. That's some of the work that we've done in the past. So the contract allows that flexibility at 171, but only at basic recruit school training.
Okay, so you don't have a problem?
We do not have a problem that I'm aware of as of today.
Okay, thank you. Bill, go ahead.
I could just quickly answer the question. DPSST does not provide maintenance training to local law enforcement, the type of skills training, weapons, physical tactics, driving. That type of training is the responsibility of the employing agency. So there really isn't that direct comparison between the type of training that the lieutenant was talking to you about for state police between what is now provided by DPSST.
But they do provide regional training, is that not correct, Bill?
There
they provide regional training around the state.
There isn't very much of that for law enforcement.
No, I realize there's not very much of it, but there is some of it, and there is some EVOC and additional training that goes on at the academy.
But the similarity question is more in the basic training.
Yeah. But I think Representative Butler and I are more focused on continuing ed. Did you have a question?
No. Let
Bill. I just want to respond to that, then I'll get to Representative Hanson.
Well, the concern I have is that it appears that we've got the ongoing training, which is the responsibility of the six FTE here, which is something under five people, as I recall. The concern I've got is that at some point, all officers have to have continuing education. And I don't care whether they're firefighters or whether they're ambulance personnel. Those hours are being provided by someone, and we've got some specialized training folks and facilities in the state. And I'd just like to know that they were being utilized to the maximum. And Representative Patridge has really touched on an item that I could be fairly touchy about, and Danny, you mentioned it, this Fair Labor Standards issue, that provides in all cases that nobody works over 171 hours in a calendar month, is that what it is?
Well, that's a period of 31 days.
Mr. Chair, it's a period of 28 days.
28 days?
Yes, 4 weeks.
So any 28-day period, they can't have worked over 171 hours.
Under the Fair Labor Standards, if they did, it would be an overtime time and a half issue. And with close work with our OSPOA during basic recruit school, we're allowed to do that without incurring an overtime issue. Traditionally, after recruit school, then anything over 8, anything over 40 would be an overtime basis.
So what would happen if
we precluded any bargaining unit from receiving this training if that training would result in any trainee overtime compensation. What would that do to our training?
Well, Mr. Chair, given that question, I would believe some training costs throughout the state probably would be at a straight time, which would be a cheaper expense than at an overtime rate.
Mr. Chair, I think that the recent layoff has really brought to my attention how much money we get invested in this kind of training, and if some of that training is being accomplished at time and a half, that's one of the reasons why we're getting so much money tied up into it. And I would have to say that particularly where these are lifetime skills, and then there's a rather substantial amount of ongoing training after that, that I feel pretty strongly that to be paid for training, and I have to really strain for that to reach out and grab a hold of that, but then to be paid at time and a half for that training is a real stretch for the taxpayers. And
you don't get time and a half for that CPA training?
No, and nor do you, Mr. Chair, when you go for your professional training. So I guess the concern that I have is that we're dealing with folks that are professionals here. And I thought that once you were a professional, I don't care whether you're a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer or an OSP, you're a professional. And I thought somewhere in that process that we treated professionals a little bit different with regard to overtime. I must be wrong.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I certainly have labor experts that can have the discussion. Certainly management professionals, whatever the definition is, we certainly do not get overtime. And one thing I probably failed to mention also is many of our training after the academy, if we certainly schedule those in advance, we work very closely with our officers to try to minimize what overtime may have to incur for those training. But certainly the 171 issue is the issue we have during the academy, which certainly saves us the time and a half.
And can you give us a number back in what you're estimating to spend and what you've sent? Maybe I don't know how easy it is to ferret out based upon the personnel record system that you have and how you quote it. I'm interested to know what you spent in overtime, what you had to spend in overtime training for the department, as well as what you're projected to, if we were to do, as Representative Butler suggests, to some degree, what kind of savings potentially we could accrue.
Mr. Chair, we'll try to get a calculation or estimate for you.
Representative Hansen.
Well, a couple things. First, get kind of a counterbalanced opinion in it, the voice of labor on. And certainly the issue of training and whether you do it at overtime or pay for it, that's certainly an issue. One of the things that I think affects working people in a lot of areas is how important is the training, and is the training mandatory, and who's deciding how important it is. I mean, if you're asking somebody to give up their free time for training, you know, their day off or come in on evening for training, and you want them to do it for free, you ought to have a discussion with them in terms of how valuable it is. I think that's one of the things that, I face in the get called in for training that either isn't perceived by the workforce as being very valuable, or maybe it's such an integral part of your job that, you know, an employer, and I don't care if it's a state public employer or a private employer, but if they buy new equipment or new computer works and stuff, and have changed the definition of your job, they ought to train you on their time to learn how to use it. I think it's something that kind of can fall under labor management negotiations, and it's better to work it out with the discussion through the employees. But certainly, like as a plumber, ongoing continuing education is something that we do on our own time and pay for the cost of it.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with that. The concern I've got is how much of it is at overtime rate.
How much is it's time and a half versus regular straight time?
The concern I've got isn't the fact that we're paying for the training, because you're right. If it's valuable and it adds to the value of our professional ability, that we should pay for it. the question I got is that basically what happens is that if I end up paying the overtime rate, I'm putting an officer out of work virtually because of the cost. I'm putting an officer out of work for about every three people that I train. And that isn't because they're overtrained. It's because they're being trained on time and a half overtime.
And that becomes a scheduling issue more than,
absolutely.
More than anything else.
And Reverend Patrick's
the other question I had, in terms of training after February 1st and after the incredible layoffs that have occurred within the state police, how did you completely restructure your planning goals? It seems like the age of your workforce, the experience of your workforce has changed dramatically and virtually overnight. How have you adjusted your training to relate to the new reality of what the state police look like now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'll take a shot at kind of overall, and then if Lieutenant...
I don't mean just... I can read what the reductions in the training department were, but how did you refocus? How did you refocus what the needs of training were going to be in terms of?
Let me, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, speak to the non-sworn and just primarily in my division. I know that we have people that are now doing jobs that they don't have the skill sets to do, and I also realize we don't have a lot of money to send them out to get them trained. So it's a real concern. We're still in transition, and frankly, from where I sit, I'm waiting to get through this budget process to see what it is we really do look like. And then once we have those questions answered, we need to sit down and work out a training plan with the resources we have to rise to the occasion to meet the needs of those jobs they're in.
Representative Patridge and Representative Hansen, from a maintenance of the hands-on technical skills that we train our officers at a field level, again, we're talking about post-academy. We've had to look at the number of instructors that we have available and the frequency at which we offer training, and we have reduced both the number of training classes that were held. We've literally had to restructure some of the dates and opportunities that we had for officers to attend training to try to maximize how many people are coming into each session to try to keep that cost down.
But how have you had an opportunity to reassess what the difference of training needs are now compared to 3 months ago?
Representative Patrick and Representative Hansen, no, sir, we've not gone through our policies and adjusted any of those hours that were set in our policy.
All right. Other questions? You got a question, Tim?
No? I have no questions.
All right. Thanks. I was going to share with the committee the following Winston Churchill quote as we close today in light of the orange alert and what's going on. The superintendent is excused. He had to join Secretary Ridge on a conference call at 2:30. And this is the Winston Churchill quote to the president. The long arm of destiny has reached across the oceans and involved the entire life and manhood of the United States in a deadly struggle. There was no use in saying we don't want it, we won't have it. Our forebears left Europe to avoid these quarrels. We have founded a new world which has no contact with the old. There was no use in that. The long arm reaches out remorselessly, and everyone's existence, environment, and outlook undergo a swift and irresistible change. What is the explanation, Mr. President, of these strange facts, and what are the deep laws to which they respond? I will offer you one explanation. There are others, but one will suffice. The price of greatness is responsibility. If the people of the United States had continued in a mediocre station, struggling in the wilderness, absorbed in their own affairs, and a factor of no consequence to the movement of the world, they might not have remained forgotten and undisturbed beyond their protecting oceans. One cannot rise to be, in many ways, the leading community in the civilized world without being involved in its problems, without being convulsed by its agonies, and inspired by its causes.
That's the Churchill quote for today.
Thank you,
I just thanks say, for indulging
Chair,
me.
I would say, Mr. Chairman, the more we get together and talk about these issues, and I don't care what party we are talking about.
Go ahead.
We find ourselves more in agreement than we do in disagreement.
All right. At this point in time, we're adjourned.